There is a difference between listening to somebody talk and interacting with living history. Good morning, Colorado. Good morning, the world. This is Kim Greenhouse. I'm delighted you're listening today because today is, in fact, a segment on exploration and discovery. In 1967, an international space treaty was formed, which was an international effort that laid down the clear context and highest intent regarding what exploration in outer space was to be about. The world is fascinated with outer space, and particularly the United States of America. You know, the imagination is exciting, and the prospect of the future beyond this planet has always been compelling. However, there is danger lurking when the polarization and misuse of power on Earth begins to have its way in outer space. Years ago, I was deeply shocked and saddened when I personally experienced that our planet was on the market. But I was horrified when I read in the Christian Science Monitor that perhaps outer space may be on the market, that people and organizations have been paying money for lunar deeds, that monies are being transacted in this area, and that ownership laws on Earth are being projected into space. But wait, we have good news, because we have the living history of the origin of this International Space Treaty. The woman you're about to meet was part of the drafting of the NASA Law of International Cooperation. She was the honorary director of the International Institute of Space Law. She's a trustee and emeritus of the International Academy of Astronautics. She is considered the grand matriarch of space law. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Eileen Galloway to It's Rainmaking Time. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm glad you're here.
Yes, I'm here.
You represent at least 98 years of living history.
Yes.
And I know us women are very sensitive about our age being told, but the truth is that you were around at the formation of all of this. And this is very important that you're able to talk about your take and your experience of what happened and what is happening and where are we today. And with that, I'd like to ask you, what was the reaction when the Russians were first to launch a satellite in outer space in 1967? What happened?
Well, it was very exciting. It was on a Friday afternoon that we learned that the Soviet Union was first to launch a satellite. We had not known that they were so advanced in rocketry. And it was a great shock as this satellite went around in 90 minutes all over the Earth and affected all nations. And it was like a psychological bomb on Capitol Hill. And it was viewed as a problem in national defense. And it was therefore considered to be a military problem.
And how did you become involved in all this? And what's your background working on the problem that arose?
Well, it was necessary for us to become prepared, to know to what extent we were prepared. And I had written a booklet on guided missiles in foreign countries that was published by the House and Senate. And I had worked on the Atomic Energy Act and for the Atomic Energy Commission. And therefore, I was called upon to work on space. And on Monday morning, Lyndon Johnson called and asked if I could help with the hearings. So the hearings began on the Preparedness Investigating Subcommittee. And they went on for many weeks. And these hearings were only 3 weeks after the Sputnik went up.
And what were they about? What are these hearings? What was covered in these hearings?
Well, when we first started out, we considered that this was a problem of national defense. But when we called up the scientists and engineers to testify, we discovered that if we could use the information we got from outer space, that there were many wonderful but beneficial uses. And therefore, our concept of the problem changed from one of fear of orbiting weapons of mass destruction to one of hope for peace. And the problem was how to organize in order to maintain peace, safety, and order in outer space.
And is this why space law began in the United States of America, and how did it actually form?
Well, the first thing that the Congress had to do was to decide on how to organize this. They had to decide how to organize the Department of Defense, because they were the only ones that had any space activities going on, and how to organize a new civilian space program. And it was President Eisenhower who made the decision to have a civilian program. And then we had to learn how to coordinate and have central guidance for the different subjects that were covered by outer space, and how to harmonize U.S. national and international.
Did Congress meet this challenge?
Yes, they did. We had hearings both in the House and in the Senate, and we finally came up with a NASA Act, and we had a program that was divided into two parts. One was exploration, and the other was uses. And the uses were about everything, the weather, navigation, agriculture, what we could get from remote sensing.
What is remote sensing? Because a lot of us don't know.
Well, they take pictures of the Earth, and they can tell where crops are diseased and do something about it very early on. They can tell how long it takes ice to melt and whether there's going to be a flood and where it will be. And there are many, many uses.
Is that the same thing as GPS or the satellite photography?
Yes.
Okay, so remote sensing is satellite photography.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
That's taking pictures of the Earth.
Because many of us don't know what remote sensing is.
And, of course, it covers navigation.
What was the role that the U.S. played in the U.N. developing outer space law?
Well, there were three forces that converged so that we could go from thinking we were solving a problem that was solely military to a problem where we were including science and technology and the benefits from outer space. Those forces were the nation states of the whole world, International Geophysical Year that the scientists and engineers were carrying on, and the United Nations that could serve as a forum where all these things could be discussed and where we could formulate space treaties.
And when the space treaty was first formed, what were the problems in the original formation of it? I mean, with the formation of anything, there are challenges. But what were the original concerns and main problems in early formation?
Well, we had to set up a special unit in the United Nations to deal with that. And it was very exciting. President Eisenhower asked, who was the Republican president, asked the Democratic leader of the Senate, Lyndon Johnson, to go to the United Nations and set up the Ad Hoc Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. And that was very exciting. Eisenhower sent a plane down to Texas. I happened to be in Texas at the time and was on the plane with Lyndon Johnson and Lady Bird. And we landed at LaGuardia and were met by Henry Cabot Lodge. And we proceeded to gather up all the other countries that we could in order to set up the organization that would work on formulating the space treaties.
What were some of the problems that you faced then that were emerging?
Well, the first problem was that the Russians and the Czechs and the Poles did not become a member of the Ad Hoc Committee, because there were a lot of people on it, and they were making the decisions by majority vote. And since the Russians and the U.S. were the only ones that had any kind of space, they didn't want all these other countries making the decisions. So that problem was solved by deciding that all decisions would be made by consensus, that everybody on the committee would have to agree before they can come to a conclusion. And that was indeed how the treaties were formed. There are five space treaties. Four of them have been accepted by most nations. The main treaty is the 1967 treaty, and it has been ratified by 98 nations.
Stand by, Eileen. Ladies and gentlemen, you are tuning into It's Rainmaking Time. We are live on the Radio Colorado Network and streaming live on the Internet. We have Eileen Galloway here, who is one of the founding members of the International Institute of Space Law. She is the Grand Matriarch of this law, and we are delighted to have her here as she is part of Living History today. Thank you again for being here. Please continue to talk to us about the Space Law Treaty.
Well, on September the 22nd, 1960, President Eisenhower went to the United Nations and addressed the General Assembly and said that we agree that celestial bodies are not subject to national appropriation by any claims of sovereignty. And then we agree that the nations of the world shall not engage in warlike activities on these bodies. And then we agree, subject to verification, that no nation will put into orbit or station in outer space weapons of mass destruction. And all launchings of spacecraft should be verified in advance by the United Nations. So we pressed forward with a program of international cooperation for constructive, peaceful uses of outer space under the United Nations. And we were looking for better weather forecasting, improved worldwide communication, and more effective exploration, not only of outer space, but of our own Earth. And these are but a few of the benefits of such cooperation.
But also, Eileen, there was another treaty, the Moon Treaty, that was formed. Can you talk about that?
Yes. The Moon Treaty was formulated in the same way as the others, but it was not accepted. It's only been ratified by 10 nations. And the reason is that it contained a provision that there should be a body there, an executive body, that would handle the moon, and that it would be anything that they did there that resulted in benefits would be distributed among all countries of the world. And this was so vague, and it wasn't in line with the other provisions, and therefore the moon agreement has not been ratified by any of the spacefaring nations. But we already have the wording for peaceful uses and how to handle the military in the 67 treaty. So we are not without legal methods of dealing with this problem.
How do you feel about the fact that there are organizations and individuals that are transacting money, taking money from other people, and selling lunar deeds on the moon, on Mars, and on Mercury? I want to know how you feel about it, and how do you feel about an organization that is in Nevada that is selling this type of property all over the world and creating its own stellar constitution, if you will?
Well, this is against the 1967 treaty. It has one article that states that outer space, the moon, and other celestial bodies is not subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty, occupation, or any other means. And in another article, they have agreed that states bear international responsibility for national activities in outer space, whether these are carried on by the government or by non-government entities. And the states are also responsible for assuring that national activities, including the moon and other celestial bodies, shall require authorization and continuing supervision by the state concerned. Now, this has not been implemented because when the selling of lots on the moon and other bodies was first started, it was considered as a kind of a lark that you got this little piece of paper and owned a lot on the moon. However, as time went on, the people who were selling made quite a bit of money. And therefore, it is up to each nation to use its legal processes to deal with the problem. The International Institute of Space Law position is that the deeds they sell have no legal value or significance, and that they convey no recognized rights. And according to international law, the states that are parties have a duty to implement the terms of that treaty within their own national legal systems. So it's up to the United States to figure out how they're going to handle this, because the state's parties have to ensure that these claims have no legal significance or recognized legal effect. Now, it seems to me that instead of trying to do away with the treaties or change the treaties with that provision that we shouldn't have sovereignty, that we have to deal with it in a more simple way. First, instead of assuming that you need to own property in order to use it, we should have a study of all the ways in which peaceful uses can be accomplished without owning the property. For example, you don't need to own a piece of the ocean in order to fish there and return to Earth and sell the fish for a profit.
That's a good example.
You can graze cattle on public land. You can have logging rights without owning the land. And you can drill for oil on offshore platforms without owning the water. So if you wanted to mine the minerals on an asteroid, and assuming you could do it safely, you don't have to own the asteroid to bring the minerals back to Earth and sell them for a profit. That would simplify the problem, because the way it is now, the fact that we do not have sovereignty and nations haven't claimed parts of the outer space is one of the things that keeps space safe and orderly.
I agree with you. Hold on one second, Eileen.
Yes.
You are tuning in to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. We are live on the Radio Colorado Network with Eileen Galloway, the Grand Matriarch of Space Law. We were talking about what really is and is not legal from the context of the space law and what would be some of the simpler ways to deal with the apparent gap or seeming loophole in the language that's being exploited. Do you have some more to say about that?
Well, I think that the people who are doing this assume that the United States is the only nation that's involved, whereas we have complete international space cooperation. We have treaties and we have all kinds of activities. NASA has in its law a provision for making international cooperative agreements with other nations. They have hundreds of agreements. We have memoranda of understanding, letters of agreements, executive agreements. And all of this is in order to develop outer space according to the two categories. One is exploration and the other is uses. And the uses include all of those that are peaceful and that you can carry on and benefit the Earth.
What about Star Wars? Some people must be saying to themselves, well, what about Star Wars? Wasn't the formation of Star Wars in violation of the very purpose of the exploration and discovery and the peaceful purposes? What were we doing with that?
Well, Article 4 of the 1967 treaty provides that the states undertake not to place in orbit around the Earth any objects that are carrying nuclear weapons or any other kinds of weapons of mass destruction, which would include chemical and biological. And they're not supposed to install the weapons on celestial bodies or station them in outer space in any other manner. So that is something we have to watch out for, and it's a complicated problem.
Yes. I'm trying to figure out, was the United States, in effect, in violation of that Article 4 by having space-based weapons in outer space, from your experience and your from your perspective?
Well,
I know it's a tough question, but it's a good one.
we don't have orbiting weapons of mass destruction, and or other weapons. What we were developing were anti-missile missiles.
Okay. Is that what Star Wars was?
If another nation shot a missile, and that has not proved to be completely effective now, that's something that they're still working on. The whole thing is complicated because you could have mass destruction with activities that are not usually considered as weapons. For example, your communication system, your worldwide communication system.
Right.
That holds all the Earth together.
So you mean if something were deployed that would knock out a satellite? Is that what you mean? Can you explain that a little further? Because that's interesting and that's very important. That's a very good point.
That is what keeps the nations cooperating. The international space cooperation is really complete. And it's in our national law and it's in the international law. And that is something that we have to watch out for, especially now that we have terrorism.
So
because you could do a lot of damage by destroying communication systems.
You mean...
You don't always have to have an atomic bomb to do it. It would be very disruptive to have anything like that.
So is that an anti-missiles missile? Is that what you're talking about, by having something that could stop something that could, let's say, put out a satellite?
Yes.
Okay.
That's not an orbiting weapon.
Right. Okay, I got it. Well, these distinctions are very critical. An orbiting weapon, having weapons of mass destruction, that whole universe has evolved, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Now, in the NASA Act, the policy, the space policy that Congress declared was that it's the policy of the United States that activities in space should be devoted to peaceful purposes for the benefit of all mankind. And in the Treaty on Principles Governing the Activities of States, that's the 67 Treaty, it provides that the exploration and use of space, including the moon and other celestial bodies, shall be carried out for the benefit and in the interest of all countries, irrespective of their degree of economic and scientific development, and shall be the province of all mankind. So our national law and our international law are in harmony.
That's interesting.
And according to Article 6 of the United States Constitution, we have peaceful purposes.
Then I just wonder how it is that the people that are selling deeds to the moon in other locations haven't been arrested. I mean, they're actually breaking a law nationally and internationally. And I would imagine they're violating securities laws because they're selling... Well, I guess you can sell anything. You can sell a pet rock, right?
Yes. Well, it's one of the problems that has to be faced that has not been taken very seriously until just recently. And I think that something will have to be done about it. And that is why the International Institute of Space Law came out with this statement of... pointing out that we already have a law that tells you exactly how to go about this.
Yes. Why don't we give out the...
Well, it tells you have to go about it if it happens.
Yes.
But we haven't got the machinery yet for doing it.
When you say you don't have the machinery to do it, what does that mean?
Well, that means that you would have to have some organization of the government that would crack down on these people who are trying to sell lots on the moon.
But what if the government of the United States of America is very much for the commercialization of outer space? Then what do we do?
Well, according to the law and the practice, we have always been in favor of commercial use for a profit. That's one of the uses. I mean, some of the uses that you can develop from the information you get from outer space are those that make a profit. Some of them don't, but have an economic component. For example, if you save lives and property by better weather reports, that's an economic factor, but it's not a profit. If you are selling something else that would have to do with remote sensing and saving agriculture and things of that kind, you can always make a profit. And in fact, we have laws that permit this.
I'd like to open up the call-in lines right now to anybody who would like to address Eileen Galloway, the matriarch, grand matriarch of space law. You can call us at the Radio Colorado Network at 1-800-531-3815. Ladies and gentlemen, we really want to hear from you at 800-531-3815 with your questions to Eileen Galloway regarding space law, space exploration, the commercialization of outer space, and this whole subject. I'm going to give this 800 number again, 1-800-531-3815. Eileen, I asked you a few days ago on the phone what to be thinking about. How would you like to leave the Earth? We don't all get a chance to think about, and we don't focus on what we like to leave behind. You obviously are already leaving behind in your presence a huge legacy. But what are the particular areas that you'd really, if you could blink your eye, would like to see changed or developed after you're gone?
Well, I would like to see the international space cooperation continue, because that has enabled us to proceed with all kinds of profitable uses, humanitarian and economic, by using outer space for solving problems on the Earth. And otherwise, I would like to see more publicity given to things that are going well, and not have all of the news that I look at in the newspaper every day tell me about people who are being killed or some terrible thing, and not having a single story about anything that's being done correctly.
Well, I look forward to bringing that forth, because It's Rainmaking Time is dedicated to introducing positive, uplifting stories, attracting and disseminating the good in the world, and finding the people, the experiences, the stories, and the news that will transmit the upside of the lovely events going on in the world. So I'm with you, and I promise you it's going to happen. It's really, really going to happen. Now, we have a gentleman from Surprise, Arizona, named Jim on the line. Jim, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time.
Oh, thank you very much, and it's quite a privilege to talk to Eileen Galloway. I've worked for NASA for 37 years. Actually, in 1960, I was recruited from high school, and also everything that you've mentioned is extremely true. I've lived it, so I know what it's about. One of the problems that was overlooked was intergalactic ownership, which is pretty far out at this point in time. But how do we handle, you know, how would we handle, you know, somebody else's galaxy, in other words, that sort of property? But also going back again to what you said before about the spinoffs that are not recognized by what NASA has done as a civilian agency of the government is so true. And but the space law, going back to space law again, the space law part of it is so critical for future generations that a body that would enforce it, you know, either the treaties or come up with some other treaty that would make sense, you know, for future generations. I'd just like to know your take on that.
Well, I think the first thing that needs to be done is that the State Department, which has considerable responsibility for these things, should figure out an administrative plan for handling these people who are making these claims, because they are the people who are doing that do not seem to realize that if it goes on and on, it disturbs the peace. And we've been so successful so far in the treaty for under the 67 treaty, for example. The military role is spelled out explicitly, and I think that this other role should be spelled out in the same way, so that we have an administrative mechanism for dealing with these claims which cannot be recognized. Now, what we have in the treaty about the military role is that all of the nations that agreed to use the moon and other celestial bodies for peaceful purposes, they forbid the establishment of military bases and installations and fortifications, and they're not in favor of any type of weapon or conduct of military maneuvers on the moon. But the military personnel can be used for scientific research or other peaceful purposes, and any equipment for peaceful exploration can be used. So when you have something as explicit as that, which has been observed since the treaty was signed, it was ratified, you should be able to figure out this other problem. Article 4, the nations agreed not to orbit the nuclear weapons, and I'm afraid that this will be become difficult if people think that they have the right to go together and do something in outer space that is not for a peaceful purpose. If we had, for example, one state that got on the moon and had a military base, it could threaten the whole Earth. And we haven't had that so far.
Jim, I want to thank you for asking a question. Do you have anything else to say to Eileen? We have another caller on the line. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I just think she's a wonderful, lovely lady, and God bless her. And may she see her 120th birthday pretty soon.
All right. Okay, we have Roberta on the line from North Carolina, and John Galloway is holding. Roberta from North Carolina.
Yes, I'm here.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much. It's an excellent show. My question for Eileen is, to her knowledge, is there any connection with the SETI program, which is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and the possibility of life on other planets to cooperate with the 1967 treaty or any other treaties that are currently in the works or have been in the work? I think it's a very important question.
Eileen, you want to answer that?
Yes. This is about extraterrestrial intelligence. Well, there is an organization called SETI that is working on this. It's the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and they are doing considerable research, which I hope will pay off, because it is an important, very important subject.
Roberta, did you get your answer, or do you want to restate it?
No, I really didn't get the answer. What I wanted to know was, is there any connection with the treaties that have been established in 1967 or subsequent to that time with SETI? In other words, is there any interaction with SETI? I know what SETI does. I'm familiar with it. But is there any interaction? I think it's important, because what happens when extraterrestrial life is contacted and they say, you know, how can you sell portions of our planet?
That's an interesting point. Did you get that, Eileen?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, all that I know about SETI and the people here in Washington who are working on it is that they're working on it, but they haven't solved it yet. So I think that this is not being ignored at all, but that the research and the interest in it are continuing.
Okay. Roberta, is there anything else you'd like?
Thank you. I'm very grateful. She's done a tremendous amount of work, and I'm very grateful to her. So thank you, Mrs. Galloway.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you, Roberta. Do we have John Galloway who's on the line?
Yes.
Good morning. Thank you for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
John,
I'm glad to listen to my mother. I'm in Vermont listening to a radio program in Colorado on streaming audio.
It's a wild world, and pretty soon we'll be on satellite. So then what? We're going to be really close to all of you.
You're right.
We'll be in sync. John, is there anything you'd like to add to the conversation on space law and the Earth and what's happening here?
Well, Mother, you mentioned several industries that have come into existence because of the onset of the space age, the communication satellite industry, the remote sensing industry, navigation, and GPS. What do you think about new industries that people are talking about, like solar power satellites and tourism?
Well, I think there's a great deal of interest in tourism. Evidently, there are some individuals who are willing to spend millions of dollars just to go up and come down without going around very much. So I think that that will continue. The whole interest in exploration will continue.
What do you think about the communications industry? Like new satellites going up. How do you feel about more satellites going up? Because don't satellites have a certain life? Don't they have a certain lifespan like people? But, you know, satellites may only last 30 years or 50 years.
I think that there's a great need for ground stations and that all the things that are needed mean that there must be regulation by the government. I think the government cannot expect private industry to invest a lot of money unless they make a profit. On the other hand, I don't think that private industry can expect not to be regulated. Here is an environment that's entirely different from the earth, the sea, and the air, and it is governed by physical laws, lethal radiation, solar winds, the selection of orbits, the time that you have for launching a satellite, if you want to change the orbit, and you have to provide artificial gravity and protect both the vehicles and the astronauts. This means that the government and the private sector have to adjust their relationship, and it could be different for different subjects. You cannot expect that exploration and the use of exploration for profit will develop in tandem. Sometimes you get just a lot of information, as you do from the Hubble telescope, which is very important, but it doesn't make a profit. And other times you can do things that make a profit. And the relationship between the government and the private sector is changing all the time.
Do you think it's getting better, Eileen?
No, I think it's confused because there's so many subjects. There are so many subjects that can benefit on Earth from information you get from outer space.
Let's say I wanted to buy a satellite. Can a person own a satellite?
Yeah. Yes.
Really? Are there satellite brokers?
You have industries that own satellites, and they have to have permission to use the launch pad. They have to protect the vehicle. The vehicle is built with a certain design to perform its particular function, and it has to be, the information has to be gathered. And it has to be gathered from many places all through the world. It's very important for industry to understand that it has to have some restrictions from the government because, after all, the government is responsible for national defense. they can't have something going up that is going to do a lot of damage.
So it has to be regulated, or it has to be overseen, or
there has to be direct communication.
Let's go back to the part of you that talked about wanting to see positive news and communication that is positive. I heard about you through the Christian Science Monitor, and one of the reasons I order it, first of all, I like Mary Baker Eddy. I think she's a neat, was a very, very neat lady with a great body of work. But I also love the fact that their paper is not about bad news. They're not a filter for bad news and negativity. And I actually canceled my weekly newspaper, and I only get a regular newspaper on the weekends. But I'd like to see that brought into being while you're still here. And so I'm going to do what I can to bring a communications system in that only delivers positive and uplifting news and truthful news to the public. And I just want to tell you how much I appreciate you being on It's Rainmaking Time. For those of you who are interested, go to www.itsrainmakingtime.com. We'll have excerpts from the interview with Eileen, and we appreciate you listening here on Saturday mornings. This is Kim Greenhouse. Please go to www.itsrainmakingtime.com, and thank you again, Eileen Galloway. God bless you.
Well, thank you for letting me talk about this.